You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
The nation of Israel is under utter domination by the Philistines and several other nations as well. They're actually occupying the country, running it like a slave state. An example comes up later in 13. Where he says, now no blacksmith could be found in all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, otherwise the Hebrews will make swords or spears. So the Philistines, and archaeology has confirmed this, by the way, that the Philistines were one of the first peoples to get iron in this part of the world. The Iron Age began around 1200. We're here at 1150 or so, 1140, 50. And the Jews still don't have iron. So the Philistines were like, we're keeping it that way. So you'd go into battle with a bronze sword against an iron sword, and you're like, oh. It's quite an advantage. Anyway, we left off here last week where Samuel has just privately anointed Saul as king, but it hasn't come out to the public yet. So came time where they needed a formal coronation. We read that Samuel later called all the people of Israel to meet before the Lord at Mizpah. And he said, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, has declared. I brought you from Egypt. I rescued you from the Egyptians and from all the other nations that were oppressing you. But though I have rescued you from your misery and distress, you have rejected your God today. And have said, no, we want a king instead. Now, therefore, present yourselves before the Lord by tribes and clans. So, yeah, God's still not real happy about this, but he's going along with it. So Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel before the Lord, and the tribe of Benjamin was chosen by lot. Lots. You cut pieces of straw equal length. And then one of them's like half the length of the others. And you hold that up. You hold that up and people draw lots. And the one that's short is the one that's chosen. So they came down to the tribe of Benjamin. Then they brought each family of the tribe of Benjamin before the Lord. And a family of Matrites was chosen. And so they narrowed it down to one family, one tribe and one family. And then they did another drawing, and this time Saul, son of Kish, was chosen from among them. So everybody's watching this. What's going on here is that God is publicly confirming this is my choice of Saul. And by using the lots, everyone can see that, you know. Now, of course, Samuel already knows it's him. Saul knows it's him also, but the rest of the people don't know that. So it's kind of similar to what he did with Saul, where he gave him that detailed story and every piece of it came true. This is a different method used for discerning the will of God. We see it used here and there in the Old Testament, even up as far as right before Pentecost for the choosing of Matthias, but never again after that. The reason being that this form, this approach to discerning God's will is inappropriate for people who are actually indwelt by the Holy Spirit. We go to prayer and we discern the mind of the Spirit. Back then, at a more distant state, it was appropriate at times to cast lots. Well, they go looking for Saul, so where is he? He's disappeared. And they're like, they asked the Lord, where is he? And the Lord said, he's hiding among the baggage. They go back there and roust him out and drag him out in front. And here he is standing there, head and shoulders above everyone else. This dude was probably 6 feet, 6 feet 2. Because the average height of a man at this time was 5 feet to 5'1". So he's like a foot or more taller than anyone else. Very impressive. But he's obviously kind of reluctant to take this role and timid. His character changes during the course of this book. We'll see change already tonight. Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord's chosen? Surely there's no one like him among all the people." So all the people shouted, "Long live the king!" And we now have a king in Israel. Well, Samuel told the people what the rights and duties of a king were. I wish we had that written out. He wrote them down on a scroll and placed it before the Lord, i.e. in the tabernacle. And then he sent the people home. When Saul returned to his home at Gibeah, a group of men whose hearts God had touched went with him. So he had some immediate followers. But certain worthless men said, "How can this one deliver us?" And they despised him, and they didn't bring him any present. But he kept silent. Well, so next we see Paul's rise to victory. Now, Nahash, the Ammonite, this is one of these vicious, oppressing countries, came up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead, a city on the east side of the Jordan. And they've got it pretty much surrounded. And so they're giving up. They're like, "Make a covenant with us and we'll serve you. You know, we'll give you money. You can make us go work for you. We surrender." And his answer was, "Okay, I'll make a deal with you on this condition, that I'll gouge out the right eye of every one of you, and thus I'll make it a reproach on all of Israel." So gouge out the right eye of everyone in the city. This kind of stuff actually happened. In one battle, Julius Caesar, a city in southern France resisted him, Gauls. And when they broke through and took the city, he cut off both hands from everyone in the city. They had a small mountain of hands piled up there, thousands of people. And then he distributed them all over France to kind of, you know, give out the message, this is what you get when you try to resist the Romans. And it was effective. That was about the end of the Gallic Wars. So that's what this guy, he's not kidding here. He would do this. Why are they always fighting? Why are we, throughout the Old Testament, we're often seeing people warring with each other? And when you read something like this, that's why. It's one thing to be a pacifist in the modern world, where we can probably avoid wars most of the time. But when you're in a situation with people this vicious, you got to fight. You got to fight. And that's why warring was a necessary part of their existence at this time. The elders of Jabesh said to him, "Well, let us alone for 7 days. We got to think about this. Give us 7 days. And he's like, apparently not in any hurry. So they sleep out some messengers, and they go running over into northern Israel, seeing if they can find anyone to help them out. And they came to Gibeah, where Saul was staying, and they spoke these words in the hearing of the people. And all of the people lifted up their voices and wept. Such an agonizing thing. And now Saul came in from the field from behind the oxen, and he said, "What's everyone weeping for?" And so they related the words of the men of Jabesh. And then the Spirit of God came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. And so he took a yoke of oxen and chopped them in pieces and sent them probably on wagons throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of his messengers, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to your oxen." Your oxen are going to look like this if you try to get out of fighting. That was one of the problems with the Israelites. They were disunified and had low morale. They weren't a unified fighting force. It's probably why they wanted a king. When the dread of the Lord fell on the people, and then they came out like one man. Everybody swarmed out. Then they said to the messengers who had come, "Thus you say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow by the time the sun's hot, you'll have deliverance." So they go back into the city. They make it in. They told the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Then they told Nahash, tomorrow we'll come out to you and you can pluck our eyes out or whatever it is you're going to do, but we're going to enjoy our eyeballs for one more night. But before that could happen, the next morning Saul put the people in three companies, his army, and they came rushing into the midst of the camp at the morning watch, so just at dawn. Probably a lot of drinking going on, guys are out cold. From every direction, they're striking down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Those who survived were scattered so that no two of them were left together. So the whole army is just either killed or scared away. And it's a big victory for Saul. It's not as complicated as it sounds. The little dotted red lines on the left are the Jews coming together to form their army. The blue line is the Ammonites. And then Saul comes over and you have the battle there. Then the people said to Samuel, who's the ones that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring them here so we can put them to death. We're going to squash all disloyalty to Saul. But Saul says, not a single man will be put to death this day. For today, the Lord has accomplished deliverance in Israel. So, yeah, his attitude's pretty good. Good job, Saul. He gathers up the people, and in chapter 12, Samuel recites a history of Israel, starting all the way back beyond the Exodus and all the way through the period of the Judges. And through the whole thing, the theme is God warns the people, you need to follow me, not some other idols, whatever. They always slip away, and then God withdraws his protection. And so that's been a pattern for hundreds of years in Israel. I'm not going to read the chapter because we want to go on with our narrative story. The first time that Saul inserts self as a manipulating agent into the situation instead of trusting God. This happened, first of all, we read Saul was 30 years old when he became king and he reigned for 42 years. It's a long reign. There's a textual variant in this verse where different manuscripts are missing different parts of the numbers. So we're actually not sure how old he was when he became king. But the 40 years reign is probably solid. Saul selected 3,000 special troops from the army of Israel and sent the rest of the men home. He took 2,000 of the chosen men with him to Michmash in the hill country of Bethel. The other 1,000 went with his son Jonathan. So he's got a son named Jonathan, a big player in this book, to Gibeah in the land of Benjamin. Soon after this, Jonathan attacked and defeated the garrisons of the Philistines at Geba, and the news spread quickly among the Philistines. So Jonathan leads his 1,000 men, took out a garrison at a city. Saul blew the ram's horn throughout the land, saying, Hebrews, hear this, rise up and revolt. So they're going to have their own revolutionary war against the dominating Philistines and the other peoples. When Israel heard the news that Saul had destroyed the Philistine garrison at Geba, and that the Philistines now hated the Israelites more than ever, so the entire Israelite army was summoned to join Saul at Gilgal. The Philistines mustered a mighty army of 3,000 chariots, 6,000 charioteers, and as many warriors as the grains of sand on the seashore. In other words, a lot. Hyperbole there. They camped at Michmash east of Beth Avon, so the two forces are camped across from each other. We're going to have war. The men of Israel saw what a tight spot they were in. They're looking at the size of this army over there, and they're like, I didn't sign up for this. Good Lord, look how many of them there are. And they start to chicken out. They start to defect. Some, they were hard-pressed by the enemy. They tried to hide in caves, thickets, rocks, holes, and cisterns. Some of them even crossed the Jordan River and escaped into the land of Gad and Gilead. So his army is disintegrating. They're falling apart. Just on the threat, they haven't even joined battle yet. And these guys probably aren't going to fight too well. If they're that scared, frightened troops don't usually have a lot of fight in them. So it's a difficult situation. Yes, it is. Meanwhile, Saul stayed at Gilgal, and his men were trembling with fear. And Saul waited for 7 days for Samuel, because Samuel had instructed him to do so earlier. But Samuel didn't come. Saul realized that his troops were rapidly slipping away, that my army's falling apart. So he demanded, bring me the burnt offering and the peace offerings that we're supposed to give to the Lord before this war. And then Saul sacrificed the burnt offerings himself instead of waiting for Samuel to come. Saul is not a Levite. The priests are supposed to be Levites. They're the ones that do the offerings and stuff. Saul is a Benjamite. He has no business doing this at all. But he's taken over. He's basically, I'll just make this happen myself. That's Saul's attitude. And just as he was finishing with the burnt offering, Samuel arrives. Oh, if he had waited just minutes longer, it wouldn't have been a problem. And so Saul goes out to meet him. Samuel's looking up there at this smoke going up. Samuel says, what have you done? And Saul said, well, because I saw the people were scattering from me and you didn't come within the appointed days and that the Philistines were assembling at Michmash. Therefore, I said, now the Philistines are going to come down against me at Gilgal. I won't have asked favor of the Lord. So I forced myself and offered the burnt offering. Saul, yeah, instead of saying, oh, man, I messed up. I'm sorry, I blew it. He's blaming his troops for defecting. He's blaming the Philistines for menacing him. He's blaming Samuel for being too late. And it's all these other factors. And then, you know, I just had to force myself. There was nothing else I could do, basically. So it becomes a trait of Saul's. He doesn't know how to confess his sin and admit it. He's too proud. Tries to shift blame onto others. Well, Samuel said to Saul, you have acted foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you. For how now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. But now your kingdom shall not endure. The Lord has sought out for himself a man after his own heart. It's King David, who's coming up next week. We'll meet him. And the Lord has anointed him as ruler over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. So failing to wait and taking over and running these sacrifices himself was injecting self into the situation. Saul was basically trying to seize the situation and make things happen his way. It's kind of like he's saying to himself, well, since God isn't going to come through, I had to take matters into my own hands. I mean, I waited 7 days. What more do you want? But the fact is, I didn't wait enough. It's not even clear that Samuel was late. Because most people think he came at the end of the seventh day, and this was still within that framework. Remember last week how God showed Saul that string of signs. The three loaves, he's going to say this, they're going to do that, there'll be, you know, two men, and so forth. And all of that came true. Boom, 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 boom. From that point on, Saul knows that God is in this. He knows that God's behind him. And he has no reason to doubt that whatsoever. So it makes him more culpable here. Taking matters into your own hands. It's what people do when they doubt that God's going to come through. And so they seize the moment. And so unlike a sin of omission, like with Eli, doing nothing, being a doofus, this is the kind of sin of commission where you're taking over and running things in the power and the energy of the self. Instead of trusting God. As we go through Saul's life, this tendency becomes more and more obvious and more disastrous. Well, here's another example, Saul's foolish vow. The war there is not really joined yet. Jonathan, the son, says to the young man who is carrying his armor, "Come and let's cross over to the garrison of these uncircumcised dudes. Perhaps the Lord will work for us, for the Lord is not constrained to save by many or by few." You know, his armor bearer is like, "Just the two of us? I'm going to go over there?" And he's like, "Yeah, because if God's in it, it won't matter if there's two or 20,000, you know, it's God." So he's like, "Okay." And Jonathan proposes, "If they say to us, 'Wait, and we'll come over there,' then that means God's not in it. But if they say, 'Come on up to us,' then we will go up. And because the Lord's given them into our hands." So they're doing something here called fleecing God. You see this for the first time in the book of Judges, where Gideon put fleece out, sheep fur, and said, "If there's dew on the fur but not on the grass, then I'll know you want me to launch this attack." And that happened. The next day he said, "No, wait, was it the grass or the fleece? I think what I meant to say, if there's dew on the grass but not on the fleece, then that happens too." So he basically accepts, okay, it's God's will. And it's kind of a reverse method of confirmation that God uses, where instead of God saying this and this and this and this is going to happen, the human is saying, if this happens exactly this way, then that'll be a message. Again, we don't use this technique for discerning God's will anymore. It disappeared after the Old Testament time. Well, both of them revealed themselves. They climbed the cliff over, and they were on the Philistines are on some high ground. They showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines, and the Philistines said, "Oh, look, the Hebrews are coming out of the holes that they've been hiding themselves." So they knew about that, what was happening. So the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, "Come on up to us, and we'll tell you something." Oh, that's exactly the quote unquote, "Come up to us." That's what they're looking for. And Jonathan's like, "Let's go. We got this." They came and he says, "Come up after me, for the Lord's given them into the hands of Israel." They killed 20 men in all, and their bodies were scattered over half an acre. So this is a raid, obviously not a full-scale war. But the Philistines are looking and saying, "Why can't somebody get him? You know, he keeps wiping out anyone that steps up." And they start to believe maybe he's got God on his side. A very typical thought that ancient people had, that the battle would be won if you had a more powerful God. Suddenly, panic broke out in the Philistine army, both in the camp and in the field, including even the outposts and raiding parties. Just then an earthquake struck and everyone was terrified. Perfect time for an earthquake to strike. They're looking around. Yeah, that's not a coincidence. And so, unlike modern people, of course, these people believed in the supernatural. They attributed things to the supernatural. So this was not a stretch for them to believe that these guys might have their God fighting with them. Then Saul shouted to Ahijah, "Bring the ephod here." The ephod, the vest that the priest wore, and in it is the Urim and Thummim. Another method for discovering God's will. It could only answer certain questions, and it only gave an answer of yes or no. But they would cast these, whatever they were. Some people think they were pieces of bone, objects, and it would, anyone could interpret it. And he said yes or no. So Saul's going to ask of the priest, get the priest to ask God, should we attack at this point? But as he's doing that and talking to the priest, the confusion in the Philistine camp grew louder. He can hear people shouting, the sound of a big crowd over there. So Paul finally says to the priest, "Never mind, let's get going." same thing again. Why would we wait here and go through questioning God's will? Forget about that. Let's go. And he's putting himself back in charge. And in more ways than one. Saul and all of his men rushed out into battle and found the Philistines killing each other. There were terrible confusion everywhere. Well, is that really? Yeah. They're not dressed in uniforms like in modern armies, or even in later imperial armies would have uniforms. These guys, it's too early for that. They don't know each other. God's confusing them. And there's also random hundreds of Israelites running out from different direction as a lot of the people that had run away decided, okay, I'm back on your side again. And so we read that even the Hebrews who had previously gone over to the Philistines revolted and rejoined with Saul. So a bunch of them apparently were like, we'll fight with you, with the Philistines against the Israelites. We're switching sides. Now they see this happen, they're like, we're back with them again. So they're coming from all directions. Likewise, the men of Israel who were hiding in the hill country of Ephraim joined the chase when they saw the Philistines running. And so we've got a full-blown defeat going on. The Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle continued to rage even beyond Beth-Avon. This is the message that this text is trying to get across, that it was the Lord that saved that day. That's perfectly obvious. But there's a little dark shadow behind the great story. We read that now the men of Israel were worn out that day because Saul had made them take an oath saying, let a curse fall on anyone who eats before evening, before I have full vengeance on my enemies. So no one ate a thing all day. So apparently Paul's thinking, okay, well, if they're denied food, then they'll fight harder so that they can make it to the dinner table, something like that. And yet, if you've ever been in a fight, like a street fight or something like that, it's one of the most exhausting things you can do. Within seconds, you're just exhausted. To fight all day with nothing, no nutriment, what a dumb idea that is. Well, even though they found honeycomb on the ground in the forest, they didn't even touch the honey because they all feared the oath they had taken. Jonathan, on the other hand, wasn't there when Saul made this oath. He was up, he was the first one that started fighting. And so he found the honey too, and he dipped his stick in it and licked the honey off. And after he ate it, he felt much better. Nice shot of glucose and fructose and honey. But one of the men saw him and said, your father made the army take a strict oath that anyone who eats the food today will be cursed. That's why everyone's so weary and faint. And then Jonathan's like, oops. Jonathan's like, my father's made trouble for us all. He exclaimed, a command like that only hurts us. See how refreshed I am, and now that I've eaten this bit of honey? Yeah, he could easily see the foolishness of Saul's vow. Later, they come back, the victory is won, they're back in camp, and somebody tells Saul, I saw Jonathan eating some honey. And so Saul confronts him. Tell me what you've done, Saul demanded of Jonathan. I taste a little honey, Jonathan's admitted. It's only a little bit in the end of a stick. Does that deserve death? And Saul's like, yes, Jonathan. You must die. May God strike me dead if you're not executed for this. And everybody standing around is just like, what? Saul's too proud to admit he had done wrong and that this was foolish. And now he's going to stick behind his pride to the radical extreme of killing his own son. But the people broke in and said to Saul, should Jonathan, who saved Israel, did they die? Far from it. As surely as the Lord lives, not one hair on his head will be touched, for he has been used of God to do a mighty miracle today. So the people rescued John, and he was not put to death. And Saul kind of had to slink home. So it's probably pretty embarrassing. Well, the vow, another case where Saul's trying to manipulate people by, you know, the energy of the flesh. And he's not trusting God like he should be. Instead, he's coming up with his little scheme that he thinks will make people fight harder. Autonomous manipulation of others. That's what Saul is guilty of. Autonomous because it's not directed by God. It's his own idea. And manipulating. Saul continued to win victories. We read that when Saul had secured his grasp on Israel's throne, he fought against his enemies in every direction. Against Moab, Ammon, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. And wherever he turned, he was victorious. So this was the awesome part of Saul's reign early on. He was a good general. Also, he did great deeds and conquered the Amalekites, saving Israel from all those who had plundered them. An important thing to note, these are not wars of aggression. These are wars of self-defense. Because they're being plundered and owned by these guys who are taking away their food and taking them people away as slaves. And they don't belong there. You know, they're invaders. So they had to be driven back to their own countries. Well, so Saul gets started. You can see, we've seen that Saul, God started out with Saul using crystal clear revelation and gave him a personal assurance that he was behind him. By all those signs he gave. He did the same thing again when they cast the lots. Thousands of people eliminated, finally came down to one man. They pulled it out. It's Saul. He was a good general. He could have been a great king. People followed him. They fought for him. He knew how to win battles. But then there's this negative note that keeps appearing, and it gets worse and worse in Paul's life. He thinks God needs his help. And that's not a posture of really trusting God. That's a posture of trusting self. A lot of times fame and success can have this result. And you do see Saul kind of started out withdrawing, hiding in the baggage and reluctant to come forward. Before that long, he is completely out of control and a tyrant. A dominator, killing people on every side. And it's just a sad fall from grace. Bruce Waltke is a professor of Old Testament and Hebrew. And reading his book back when I was a student about this, I read where he said, when you look at Saul's life, Saul could get other people to follow him. He couldn't get himself to follow God. And I thought, man, that's scary. Because I kind of identified with that. I wasn't that close to God at the time. I could get people to follow me. But yeah, if I'm not following God, it really makes a sham out of the whole thing. And so I really pondered that. Don't let me be like Saul, God. Okay. Well, here's our study for tonight. Yeah, God. There is a learning curve that we have to go through in terms of learning how to follow you and what it means to trust you in different situations. We just pray that we'll be eyes wide open as you teach us these lessons. And yeah, like the brother prayed, that we'll be humble enough to admit when we mess up and not to shift the blame onto other people. We pray that in God's Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.